You are listening to a sermon by Lydia Crutwell, recorded on Sunday, August 14, 2011, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for individual use only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, thank you for having me here. I visited your church a couple of times a little while ago now, and it's good to be back here again. I'm fairly local. Along with working up there, I live just down the road, so it was a lovely little walk to church this morning. As a master's student, as I said, at Regent College, summertime and the end of school mean that I'm out of my routine. Most of us, I think, are out of our routine. So summer always seems like a natural time to visit other churches, to see new things and meet new congregations. I think it goes along with all the other non-routine things about summertime, the holidays, the visits to see family, having family come to visit you, the barbecues, the afternoons at the beach when the sun is actually out. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, actually. The rest of the year, I think we need a special occasion in order to have people over for dinner. We need Easter or Thanksgiving or Christmas or a birthday or something, but not during summer. In summer, the mere fact of the season is enough justification to bring people over to your house. During summer, I think we North Americans probably come closest to understanding that impromptu sense of hospitality that Martha demonstrates in our text today, the kind of hospitality that the ancient Near East was known for, the kind of hospitality in which a single woman living with her sister could notice travelers on their way to Jerusalem, just passing through, and say, "Come, dine at my house tonight. There's going to be enough. There's going to be more than enough for everyone." As you well know, the story of Mary and Martha is one of the more famous encounters with Jesus on the way. One of the many stories that Luke tells us in that long section of the gospel where we know Christ is headed towards Jerusalem. He's headed towards his betrayal and his suffering and his death and his resurrection. But on the way, he has encounters and meetings with people. It's a really short little story, actually. I'm always surprised when I read it just how short it is, given its importance, given the impact that it's had on the church, as Christ followers grapple with what it means that Mary has chosen the better part, the part which will not be taken away from her. Over the centuries, these two women have come to represent many things. They've come to represent the active versus the contemplative life, the present world versus the world to come, Judaism and Christianity, and even justification by works versus justification by faith. And these abstract interpretations are really fascinating and helpful in their own rights. For me, it's the material facts of this story that grab me. As we just said, I work at the bakery, and so I spend a lot of time working with pastries and breads. It's not uncommon for me to open up a recipe that says, "Okay, 19 pounds of chocolate chips, go." And when I'm not at the bakery, one of my favorite activities is to have people over for dinner. It's not uncommon for me on a Friday night to have 6 or even 8 people around my small, fairly wobbly dinner table. And I'm keenly aware of how much work it would be to prepare a meal for Jesus and his 12 disciples and who knows how many other kind of hangers-on and followers. And I want us to think for a moment about the realities of that meal preparation. Setting aside the more complicated dishes that someone like Martha might make, let's assume she's just doing a really simple meal. Bread, meat, wine, maybe some figs or some dates. The figs are easy enough. You just put them in a bowl, you make sure there's no bugs in them, and you put them out. Hopefully that's enough figs for 15 plus people. Okay, now the bread. Is there enough sourdough starter to leaven that much bread? We're 1,800 years away from the discovery of dry yeast here. So you've got to have a sourdough starter, and you've got to feed it every single day. And if you use it all today, you're not going to have bread tomorrow. Furthermore, is there enough wheat ground for flour for that much bread? Remember, this is an age without electric mills. Wheat and other grains were ground by using a rotary mill, which was literally 2 stones put on top of each other. Or a hand mill called a quern, which was just really a shallow bowl which the women of the house would kneel at and scrape the grains with a rounded rock. It's a long process, it's tiring, it's hard. Archaeologists can literally identify which bones of human remains belong to women or to slaves because their shin bones would be worn down from the long hours of kneeling at the quern, grinding. So the flour has to be ground, and it's got to be mixed in with the right amount of water and starter and salt, and then it's got to be left to rise, and then it's got to be shaped into loaves, and then it's got to be left to rise again, and then it's got to be baked over an open fire or over a simple stone oven. There's no temperature gauge, there's no timers, there's no electronic aids to help in the baking process. All Martha has to make sure her bread turns out golden and light and not burned and brick-like is her five senses: touch, feel, smell, sight, and taste. All right, enough with the bread. Let's look at the meat. There's no refrigeration, so the meat must have been slaughtered no more than a few days ago, or else it would have spoiled in the heat. For more than 15 people at a special meal like this, you would want a large chunk of meat, perhaps half a goat or a sheep. It needs to be cut, needs to be dressed, it needs to be laid over the fire to roast. Again, no temperature gauge, no timers, so you're going to have to watch that meat carefully to make sure it doesn't burn on one side and stay raw on the other. Now, all this is just the food. I haven't even begun to speak about the many other things, which I'm sure you know, that turn a house into a place to host guests, to create an atmosphere which aids conversation and helps the guests feel at ease. The pillows that they would recline on, are they spread around evenly? The glasses for the wine or the water, are there going to be enough for everybody? The lamps for when the sun goes down, they're all going to need to be refilled, because it's going to take a lot of oil to keep them burning into the night. I say all this because I want you to understand the full meaning of the text when it says, Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She's not distracting herself with silly things. She's distracting herself with what is needed to make a meal for this many people. And remember, Martha didn't have this thrust upon her. She chose this out of no obligation on her part. She chose to open her home to Jesus and his disciples. She chose to become a host, to welcome in these weary, dusty travelers and give them food and rest and a place to wash the road off their feet. As a woman, as the head of a household, and as a person brought up in the culture of the ancient Near East, Martha is absolutely steeped in all the expectations of what it means to host well in this time and this place. These expectations live within her. They dwell with her. They probably hang over her a little bit. Guests in this culture are meant to be made welcome, to be fed well, to be treated like members of the family. To eat bread and salt with someone was to have them become a member of your family in this day and age. But what does Martha do when the members of her own family don't seem to be accepting their role as host? Her younger sister Mary, who could be offering basins of water to dusty travelers, or turning the meat, or shaping the dough, or refilling the figs, or any of the 101 things that need to be done, she's just sitting there. And not only is she's sitting at the feet of Jesus, in the place of a disciple. There she sits, receiving the teaching that men normally receive, shirking her duties as a woman of the house, not helping Martha one bit in her duties as a host. Martha probably would like to sit at those feet too, to hear more than just little bits of the conversation from the other room, but that's impossible. There's too many things to do. There's far too much to do for one person. As you may have gathered by now, I've got a certain sympathy with Martha. I've felt like she does many times before, and no doubt I probably will again. I call it letting my instincts to be hospitable get the better of me. It seems like a good idea on Monday or Tuesday to invite a bunch of people over to my house, but suddenly it's Friday night, it's a half an hour before the seven people I so blithely invited are going to start arriving, and I'm not sure I have enough rice, I'm tired from a day at work, and really all I want to do is lay down. But I agreed to host, so the cooking must start, and the floor really needs to be vacuumed, and I probably should get rid of those wilting flowers on the mantelpiece. But halfway through this story, it's hard to feel as charitable towards Martha as you did before, because in her moment of stress and anxiety, she turns on her sister in a very public and very nasty rebuke. She doesn't draw her sister aside quietly. She doesn't tell Martha herself that she needs to help out. Rather, Martha turns to the male authority figure in the room, Jesus, and tells him what he has to say to her sister. In a breach of hospitality and custom that's far more severe than anything Mary is doing, Martha publicly shames her sister and openly suggest that Jesus does not care about her, about Martha, about the woman whose hospitality he is enjoying. Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? Tell her to help me. In moments of stress brought on by large dinner parties, I'm sure we've all thrown a few dirty looks at family members who don't seem to be pulling their weight. But this is a little extreme. It's understandable, to be sure, but extreme. The tension in the room, I imagine, rises as the other disciples react to this breach of hospitality, as Mary herself starts back from this sudden attack, and as everyone turns to see what Jesus will say to this angry, overstressed host. Martha. Martha. Much depends on the tone of voice you imagine Jesus saying her name in. And I find I can't imagine anything other than a tone of gentle, quiet, patient love. Jesus acknowledges her pain and her frustration and her worry. He does care. He does know of the many things that Martha's doing. But then he turns those worries inside out and upside down. You are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. This simple statement is so strange, so controversial, so incomprehensible to this world of hospitality that even the transcribers and the translators have trouble with it. Some of our ancient copies of Luke say only one thing is necessary. And some of them say only a few things are necessary. And some of our translations, in an effort to kind of bring this together, combine both. The New International Version has but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Perhaps ancient transcribers got confused and they thought that Jesus was giving Martha practical advice, saying, you only need one dish, you don't need to feed us a lot, just give us one thing, that's fine. Or perhaps they simply couldn't understand how Jesus could just dismiss the whole business of hosting and hospitality in one simple sentence. It's also complicated by the fact that Koine Greek does not distinguish between positive adjectives, comparatives, and superlatives. I.e., the word agathos here, it can be translated as good, Mary has chosen what is good, or Mary has chosen what is better, or even Mary has chosen what is best. It's interesting, actually, if you read different translations to see how they've rendered it in English, because there's a lot of different ways. Is Mary's choice to ignore the duties of hosting and sit at Jesus' feet merely good? Or is it better? Or is it the best? Regardless of these sorts of text-critical issues, the fact remains that Jesus, after acknowledging Martha's many worries and cares, just blithely sweeps them all away in an affirmation that Mary, who has rejected her role as host and is sitting with the men at Jesus' feet, has made the good choice, has chosen something which will last much longer than the meat and the wine and the bread. As happens often in these stories of Jesus on the way, it all ends too soon, and we're left to wonder what the reaction to this extraordinary pronouncement is. Does the tension between these two sisters lessen or deepen with this comment? Does Martha recognize the truth of Jesus' words and leave her baking to burn in order to join Mary at his feet? Do the disciples understand what Jesus is saying, or do they too think he's giving Martha practical instructions on how to make less dishes for the meal? I don't know about Mary, and I'm not sure about the disciples, but if I were Martha, I would only get angrier at this refusal to engage with the realities of hosting. I would stomp back into my kitchen, I would turn my meat and bake my bread and pour my wine. I might even, were I sufficiently angry and frustrated, end up seasoning the meal with a few tears of my own, abandoned as I was to my fate of having to cook for this whole crowd all by myself. The only thing that gets me through my Friday dinners is the fact that I have some wonderful people around me who will say, no, sit down, I'm going to go do the dishes. No. But what do we do? How do we understand this? I mean, you can almost hear Martha's thoughts. How can Jesus, this prophet, this teacher, this man who's taken my hospitality, be so blind as to forget how much work it takes to make a meal? How can Mary, this sister who knows how little we've got, completely forget herself when we've got company over? How can it be that I am so utterly alone in my efforts to offer true hospitality to these guests? But this is all speculation, and probably a good bit of projection on my part. The reality is, we don't know anything more than the text gives us. So never mind Mary or Martha or the disciples, how do we, as readers of this text, understand it? How do we make sense of Jesus' apparent disregard for the practical elements of what it means to feed 15-plus people? How does Jesus' answer to Martha, for all its gentleness, not constitute a stinging rejection of the work she's so faithfully taken on? I've worried about this, and I've wondered about this, and I've puzzled through this for quite a while. And as I sat at my desk this week, I found my answer in a small yellow piece of paper that I'd saved from my time volunteering at Out of the Cold. Out of the Cold is a ministry run by Grandview Church off Commercial Drive. They seek to welcome and to feed street people. And this piece of paper is just a small litany that the volunteers say each week to remind themselves exactly why it is that they're chopping vegetables and buttering bread and washing hundreds of dishes and serving people of varying backgrounds, many of whom are suffering from addiction or mental illness. Let me read this litany to you. Because you first welcomed us to your table, Christ be our host. Christ be our guest. Because you too were homeless, Christ be our host. Christ be our guest. As we set up, cook, connect, and clean tonight, Christ be our host. Christ be our guest. Christ be our host. Christ be our guest. The phrase stuck with me, and it led me to ask three simple questions about this story of Mary and Martha. Three questions which were so simple, I'd actually neglected to ask them before. Who is the host here? Who is the guest? What exactly is being served? Of course, we know the answer. Mary and Martha, and perhaps to a lesser extent, Mary are the hosts. Jesus and his disciples are the guests, and food and drink are being served. But what if that's only the very surface layer of truth? Only one layer of what's going on here? What if, in fact, there are another set of answers to that question? One where Jesus is the host. Where Mary and the disciples, and yes, even Martha, are the guests. And what is being served is not food and drink, but the bread of life and the wine of the new covenant. We who host are used to a very simple dichotomy. If you come to my house, you're a guest and I'm a host. If I go to your house, then I'm a guest and you're a host. But when Jesus comes in, even if we have welcomed him in ourselves to our own house, it is not us who are the hosts, but him. It is he who welcomes us to his new life, to his table, overflowing with good things. Mary, somehow, has stumbled upon this great truth, has sat down at the Lord's table as a disciple among other disciples. But Martha, distracted as she is by the meat and the bread and the wine, by the pillows and the candles and the many duties of being a host, hasn't realized that something different is happening here. She can't see beyond the literal food that needs to be made to the feast that has already been laid out before her. And so she does not sit down. It's easy for me to feel sympathy for Martha, even in her angry words and shameful actions, because I too get distracted by the duties of hosting and by the duties of being a good, dutiful, hard-working Christian. There is much to be done, always. There are church committees to organize and Sunday services to plan. There are sermons to be written and people to care for. There are onions to be sautéed and glasses to be cleaned. But if we stop for a moment, if we turn off the onions and put the glasses in the sink just for a second and really look at our guests, then we will remember that the true center of hospitality is not about paying attention to the food or to the table, but to the guests themselves. If we pay attention to them, to what they are saying and to who they are, then we will begin to see Christ in our midst. Christ, who is the great host of hosts, who loves his guests at all times and in all ways, he who gives them the water of life itself, that they may never thirst again. My prayer this day, for myself and for you, is simply this: that we may welcome Christ in with open arms, as Martha did, so that we may receive the everlasting welcome of Christ, as Mary did. Christ be our guest. Christ be our host. Amen.